Today in Studio 360, Jodie Foster. She's the director and co-star of the new movie The Beaver, starring her good friend Mel Gibson playing a crazy person.
He's a really deep man. He understands his own complexity, and I think he understands struggle like nobody else.
And later, the singer Suzanne Vega. She has created and stars in a new show of songs and stories based on the life of the novelist Carson McCullers.
Virginia Woolf, she leaves me cold.
I based a lot of her character on photographs in all of her biographies, and a lot of times she's surrounded by people and she's laughing, which you could see that she had this kind of radiance and a certain quirky kind of charisma.
Plus, what happens when the levee breaks this time? We consider how the last great Mississippi River flood inspired a century of blues music. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with pop stars turned theater people Suzanne Vega and Duncan Sheik. They have collaborated on a new musical about the writer Carson McCullers.
She said she had more to say than Hemingway and that she said it better than Faulkner. Those are actual verbatim quotes.
And we'll hear from John Darnielle, the frontman of the indie rock band The Mountain Goats. But first on today's show, the Mississippi River is overflowing as it hasn't for most of our lifetimes right now. Parts of Memphis will be underwater for weeks.
It's a lot of water and it's a lot of worry.
This is history repeating itself.
Part of a flood protection plan cobbled together in the decades following the Great Flood of 1927.
We keep hearing comparisons to the devastating flood of 1927 that inundated 27,000 square miles of the South. That disaster was the mother of flood control invention. Locks, dams, levees, spillways. Just this week, the Army Corps of Engineers opened the Bonnie Carey Spillway just west of New Orleans, something they've rarely done since the Great Depression. But that 1927 flood also inspired a generation of the blues, and their influence can be heard today. Like Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie, who wrote When the Levee Breaks.
Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come, I have no place to stay.
Sound familiar, maybe? Well, it was covered by Led Zeppelin in 1971. And to talk about all this, with me today is Nick Spitzer, the host of the public radio program American Roots. Welcome to Studio 360, Nick.
Thanks for having me. So far, no water in the wrong places in New Orleans yet.
Yeah, although the tide hasn't really reached that far south yet, has it?
No, the crest has not here yet as we speak.
First, I want to play a bit of one of the biggest songs from that time and place, Bessie Smith's Backwater Blues.
When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark at night. When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark at night. Then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night.
That's Bessie Smith. The 1927 flood, which was one of those once-in-a-century natural disasters. Did that propel the Delta blues musicians of that era to sort of reach a wider, i.e. white, audience?
Well, you have to remember that the flood itself affected people. 90% of the people affected were African Americans. They say between 600,000 to a million displaced, maybe as many as 1,000 dying, over 150,000 homes lost. And so this is the art form to express the pain. And once that happened, it sort of became the news. It got out to more and more people. Bessie Smith was in a unique position in that she was a classic blues singer and into the jazz world. And so her performances reached more people just because she was already
right.
A somebody that was known, and that's James P. Johnson with her on piano. So, you know, blues is very much focused on the trials and tribulations of life. It's not like gospel music where maybe the wrath of God caused this flood and we're only going to be happy in the hereafter. You know, blues is really focused on the details, and the details are the metaphors for trouble and trial and life. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, this water brings the silt, brings the bottom land, and at the same time, it also takes away. It drowns people, it ruins property and crops and destroys. And so the pain of the flood is a particular irony, I think, and blues is how it gets expressed. I mean, there were dozens and dozens of blues songs written. Most of these were done after the fact.
Right.
Bessie Smith's, by the way, was done written before and just anticipated what was going to happen.
You produced, Nick Spitzer, a great album a few years ago called New Orleans 2005, which featured covers of Backwater Blues and other songs about the 27 flood, including a new arrangement of Randy Newman's Louisiana 1927, which I want to play a little bit of.
River rolls all day, the river rolls all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River has busted through, clear down the Plaquemines.
Randy Newman has New Orleans roots, and you're a New Orleanian who lived through Katrina. Do you feel some, in addition to regional kinship, and you're a scholar of the music of the last 100 years, do you feel, did the flood give you some kind of make-your-bones sense of kinship with those people from 27?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think everybody here lives with a certain amount of fatalism about living in a floodplain and living on an eroding coast. And I think that Randy Newman, in his Jewish tradition, is beautiful with the fatalism that maps lovely onto the Catholic fatalism of southern Louisiana. But there's no question. I think anybody that faces or tastes the wave, as some would say here, feels something about that being inundated and the pain and fear that goes with it. And of course, Randy Newman made that out of the West Coast Tin Pan Alley world. And yet it speaks here so loudly that everybody plays that on the jukeboxes in the clubs of South Louisiana. And it says we're trying to wash us away. Everybody kind of has that same feeling that that is possible.
And are these 21st century inundations in that part of America inspiring new music?
Well, you know, nobody asks for pain to produce creativity in life, but
yes,
it sometimes happens that way. And I, you know, in New Orleans post-Katrina, we've had a tremendous recovery in part because of all this new music and built on the old culture and the old styles of jazz and rhythm and blues and soul. And much of the return and the recovery here has been generated by performance and a sense of participating in music and the second lines and all these kinds of things. So there's an interesting sort of return to creative ground in the vernacular, I suppose. But as far as what we're facing now, looking at this rising river, nobody's thinking about future creativity. They're just worrying about, you know, how will I get to higher ground? Do I need to be there? And will the levees break? And will they open the old river control structure in Morganza and relieve the pressure on New Orleans? And will we end up, you know, more like where Memphis was and some of the Iowa farmlands? And that question now is being posed for the Atchafalaya spillway, where, you know, a lot of water is going to probably displace as many as 2,500 individuals. So we're facing that now and wondering where we're going to be in a few days.
I realize, as I've been watching the news this week, I've never heard the word floodgate used except metaphorically until this week. And now I'm hearing it all the time as a real thing.
Yeah, well, it's one of those metaphors of relieving pressure,
yes,
I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nick Spitzer, stay dry, stay safe, and thank you very much.
Thanks so much for speaking with me, Kurt.
Nick Spitzer is the host of the American Public Media show, American Roots.
How high's the water, mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. But we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats, 2 feet high and rising.
The new movie The Beaver falls into no neat pigeonhole, I can imagine. It's a hybrid of comedy and harrowing drama. It stars Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster. Gibson plays this deeply depressed businessman whose life has gone down the tubes. Then he discovers he can function, but only if he talks through a puppet on his hand. The puppet is a sweet, cheerful beaver with a Cockney accent.
Henry, mate.
Could see if you can find that varnish we was talking about.
I'll get it.
Thanks, mate.
Did you read the card?
Yes,
I... Read the card.
I've...
Read the card.
The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet designed to help create a psychological distance between himself and the negative aspects of his personality. Please treat him as you normally would, but address yourself to the puppet. Thank you.
There you go.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet. Right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
That is Jodie Foster in The Beaver, co-starring Mel Gibson. She plays the wife of this depressed, nutty protagonist. She is also the film's director, and she's here with me now. Jodie Foster, welcome to Studio 360.
Oh, thank you.
So how did this not obvious story come about, and what made you think this is something you should make a movie about?
Well, this particular script was on something called The Blacklist.
I can imagine, whatever that means.
It's a list of the 100 best unproduced screenplays, but uh-huh. screenplays in that year that probably don't have a chance of help being made. And we all get to read them. You can actually read them all online. And I read it and said, wow, this is something extraordinary. I knew that it had been set up already with another actor and a director, and I was hoping that if something bad happened to them that I would just jump right in.
So the way the beaver talks, was that in the script, or did you and Mel Gibson determine that, oh, it should be this funny, bouncy, Cockney guy?
Well, it was always an English accent. And then when Mel came on, I think we refined what that meant. And what we looked for first was to find the character of Walter Black, a man who's lost. And he was kind of, you know, a kid who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, whose job had been handed to him by his father. He has a family who loves him, but he's a broken man who can barely speak for himself and is just a puddle of emotion in some ways. And the beaver is not that. He's everything but. So that brought us to a kind
of... The beaver is happy.
He's happy, but he's kind of emotionally remote. He's a leader. He's vital. He wants to live. And he's a hardworking scrapper beaver who clearly comes from South London. You know, he was not a born aristocrat. And he's everything that Walter would like to transform into. You know, Walter doesn't want to be himself. He wants to be different.
Did you have to, or did you feel you needed to go talk to psychiatrists, shrinks, investigate if this is a plausible thing that somebody in this condition might do?
Well, I knew that in psychology and psychiatry that almost all the therapy you do with children, especially pre-verbal children, is usually with puppets. So it's not outrageous to think that a puppet would be a helpful tool, a survival tool, really, for somebody who is unable to communicate in any other way. But this is a fable. You know, there's not real people walking around with puppets on their hands. And I think that's what's interesting about the film is that it does have a fable quality. It has a light touch to it. It has a wit to it. And yet it's fully grounded in reality. And it has a rawness and a primitiveness to it, too.
So, Mel Gibson, he's been a close friend of yours for a while?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've known him for 15 years. We worked together on Maverick and had an amazing time together and then continued our friendship from there.
So he's had all this multifaceted life bumpiness that we've all read about. And you've referred to him in connection with this movie as the Mel Factor, which is a nice conflation of all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Did you... And he want him to be this character, this wacky, crazy character, because of his public unhingedness?
I think his most public unhingedness came after the film was finished. But there's two things that are great about Mel and why he's right for the part. One is that he does have a light touch and he understands comedy. He does understand how to be funny and facile. And he's a great filmmaker, so he knows timing and all of that. But the other side of him that I know, because I've known him for so long, is that he's a really deep man. Uh-huh. And he understands his own complexity, and I think he understands struggle like nobody else. And he doesn't understand a man who wants to change, I think, from a very personal place. And I'm thrilled that he trusted me enough uh-huh. to really show me his most beautiful side that is very raw and very naked in the film. It's such an extraordinary performance, and it's really a gift.
He has played a lot of variously unhinged half crazy or fully crazy people in the Lethal Weapon movies, Mad Max, Hamlet. I mean, deep is one word, but do those roles come naturally to him in a way because of who he is?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. He's the best Hamlet I've ever seen. So maybe. There's something about he has a childlike quality about him.
Yes.
There's something childlike about him, but also something regretful as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, those two things combined, I think there is a man searching. You know, some could say there's a little madness in there. You know, yeah, there is a little madness.
On Facebook, we asked our listeners what they thought your most unsung role was ask you about. And the winner, if you will, most of them mentioned The Little Girl That Lives Down the Lane.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
From 1976, when you were 13, which I must admit, never actually seen. But let's listen to a clip.
I don't believe what you've been telling me about your father.
You don't believe he's upstairs then, huh?
No.
Father! Should be down in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Look, I understand because I haven't been telling you the truth all the time. Because my father isn't a well man. Maybe you don't understand about poets. Edgar Allan Poe was a drug addict. Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. Sylvia Plath took her own life.
Rin, we're talking about your father.
That was Jodie Foster in The Little Girl That Lives Down the Lane. And Jodie Foster here cringing. Were you cringing at the lines or your performance?
Oh, I don't know. You know, a little memory lane always makes you cringe. It's a weird little movie, directed by a Swiss director, a very Germanic film. The truth is that movies don't really play well on radio. I have to admit. Every time I hear a scene, when I'm driving in my car listening to the radio and I hear a scene from a movie, I go, wow, that sounds bad. There's something about not seeing people's faces. It just makes it not work at all.
I want to play something else. This may work better than you think that film clip worked. This is you as a young person doing a very different version of Jodie Foster.
Viens, petit clo-clo, dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des...
Oui,
des
clip-crap,
des
bandes,
des
top
et des
zip-shabam.
Bow,
blop,
whiz.
Je distribue
les swings et les uppercuts. Ça fait...
Flap,
ça fait...
Splash,
et ça fait...
Chut.
Bien,
bon,
ou parfois même
switch, bam, bon, blop, whiz.
So that's...
Do you know who that is?
It's you and Claude François.
Claude François, the most famous singer in France. The original I Did It My Way, the guy who...
Yes.
I Did It My Way. Died tragically.
How did that happen? Did you have a whole secret parallel career in France we never knew about?
I did. I was... Well, I don't know. I sang one pop song that, you know, was on the charts, and that was about it. But that particular song, by the way, is a Jane Burke and Serge Gainsbourg song. It's a very, very famous song. That's why it's so weird. And we redid it and changed some of the words. It says clo-clo, which was which they used to call Claude François instead of petite fille, little girl. That was in the original song.
Is it true you dub all your own films when they're released in France?
Yeah, I dub all most of them. Sometimes I don't have the time and I'm traveling around the world and I can't do it. But yeah, I dub most of my movies in French.
You must be the only person who does that.
I probably am one of the few. Yeah, it's hard. It really is hard. And it allowed me to really perfect my French. I mean, I spoke French fluently by the time I was 9. But
you went to a French school.
I went to a French school. I lived a little bit in France. But it's hard to really perfect a language unless you some have to do something really challenging with it, you know, to make yourself better at the language.
You have acted in dozens of movies over these 45 years. Do you have
dozens? At least 50.
That's dozens.
Okay.
Do you have
one? Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm not good at math.
Do you have one or two that you would like to sort of be in the first paragraph of your obituary?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, I think the ones that are unsung in some ways, you know, Nell and The Brave One are the two best performances I think I've given and the two that were, you know, not on the big popularity pile. But I do think that Taxi Driver and Silence of the Lambs are really some of the greatest American movies. I'm just proud to have been in them.
See, this is why you're so great, because instead of hemming and hawing and not answering a question like that, you actually just straightforwardly answer it. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
As a public radio host in New York, I have to ask you about your movie from 2007, The Brave One, which is about a public radio host from New York who becomes a vengeance-seeking vigilante after she is assaulted. The role I read was originally about a print journalist.
That's right.
Why did you change it?
There were a number of reasons. I felt like I'd seen the movie about the print journalist before, and it really didn't work in terms of the narrative as well. There is something really beautiful about the sound of your own voice on a microphone, on headphones, and something really intimate. I don't know about you, but I'm an NPR head, and I find myself in the car in the garage for an hour continuing to listen before I go in.
So the intimacy of that.
Yeah, and the stories that you can tell. Also, you know, in some ways it really helped us symbolically that she's a bit of a ghost. She's a voice and no body.
Right.
Her body's been taken in some ways, and she is this invisible ghost walking through Manhattan.
I walk the streets at night now. I find places and things I never knew existed. But am I finding them? Or are they finding me?
And I guess to the degree that public radio reads as, oh, you're a liberal, for that person to become a violent armed vigilante was good, too.
Total transformation. You know, you embrace a side of yourself that you never knew was there, almost a stranger to you. And you embrace something that is so true and so authentic and is terribly ugly and incredibly beautiful at the same time. Rage, pure rage. But I will say that NPR was very keen to disassociate themselves, and I wasn't allowed to actually go to NPR to you know, she is a quote-unquote public radio person, but they didn't really want us thinking that if you become an NPR person, then you will automatically be a vigilante.
Because they've got a lot of serial killers working for them secretly.
You probably know that better than I do.
Jodie Foster, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Beaver opens nationwide on May 20th. Coming up, name that 1970 hard rock anthem. The Mountain Goat's John Darnielle on Black Sabbath.
They try not to hit you with your libido. They hit you somewhere else, in your fists, right, or in your skull.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stick around. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Last week, I talked with the novelist Arthur Phillips, who wrote an entire play that was a forgery of Shakespeare as part of his novel, The Tragedy of Arthur. And we asked you if you'd like to give it a try, to write a fake Shakespearean sonnet. And we asked Arthur Phillips to be our judge and pick a winner. As Arthur says of the winner he picked, they are clever, lovely, technically precise, romantic, and strangely moving in their argument that a snake's life is one worth envying. Well, the author of The Lost Serpent Sonnets of William Shakespeare is Sally Fisher from New York City, and I've got her on the line right now. Is that Sally?
Yes.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson.
Hi.
Sally, you're the winner. Congratulations.
No kidding.
Yes.
How wonderful.
We enlisted a trained Shakespearean actor named Alex Galifant to read your three sonnets.
And I'd like to
play some of one of them for you.
Okay.
When rampant rumor doth my ears confound, and insult hound me for my mere shape's sake, then do I pause to sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the perjured snake. The worthy serpent, by the world full cursed, in truth is innocent and full of grace, his dimensions all compact, his mind well versed. Why therefore villain, wherefore base? Regard my supple body, lithe and thin, my curling arabesques, my twin-tongued kiss. Hath not a serpent flesh, bones, skin? If struck, nay, trod upon, shall he not hiss? Fie, hedge pigs, ye are slanderers most vile, unworthy e'en to speak the name reptile.
That was one of the Lost Serpent sonnets of William Shakespeare, read by Alex Galifant. The real author, of course, is not William Shakespeare, but Sally Fisher, who I'm talking to now. It sounds pretty authentic read by him, doesn't it?
It sure does. It was really a pleasure.
And these three are told from the point of view of a snake.
That's right.
How did that concept come about?
Okay, I should explain. They're part of a theatrical performance, a piece of adult puppet theater, in which I appear as the chairman of a Shakespeare society, and the guest is a 9-foot snake who is a scholar who claims to have discovered these hitherto unknown Shakespearean sonnets.
How interesting. So, A, not only have you been working on these for a while, which mm-hmm. probably will make your fellow competitors think, oh, hey, that's no fair, but nevertheless, these were the best. But B, you also were doing something not unlike Arthur Phillips did in his novel, which is to say, pretend that this is real long-lost Shakespeare. Did you really think from the beginning, hey, I can figure this out?
A little bit. I am a poet, and I sometimes do rhyme, and I love to work at that.
Uh-huh.
Much of my poetry doesn't rhyme, but and it was also just the challenge to get the vocabulary right, and I knew I could go to concordances and things like that and make sure I wasn't using a word in a way that Shakespeare would not have used it.
Well, Sally Fisher, thank you very much for sharing these with us, and congratulations.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
We got lots of great responses for this contest, but about half of you decided to bend the rules and abandoned Elizabethan England entirely. You wrote sonnets about particle physics, insurance fraud, El Paso, Texas, and the Beatles. For honorable mention, Arthur Phillips picked his favorite modern-day sonnet called My Sister and I by Laura Heidi Halberstein. At Studio360.org, you can hear it read aloud, too, along with Arthur's second runner-up. As the real Shakespeare says at the end of his Sonnet 92, thou'st may be false, and yet I know it not. 20 years ago, just as indie rock started to be called indie rock, John Darnielle founded one of its great bands, the Mountain Goats.
Masks hanging on the tomb walls, where the coven grieves. Witches hiding in the brambles, ground level down where the dry leaves.
The critic for The New Yorker calls him America's best non-hip-hop lyricist. His songs are moody, literary, some might say even a bit navel-gazy. So you'd probably peg him for a Leonard Cohen fan or maybe Nick Drake. Turns out, no, not the case. He was and still is a metalhead. Darnielle got hooked as a kid in California.
When I was getting babysat growing up, the first thing I would do is go directly to my babysitters, as usually teenagers, and I would go directly to their room and start flipping through the vinyl, right, and see what they have. But they would have a lot of Montrose and Alice Cooper. But the first thing I heard was Iron Man by Black Sabbath. And the first thing you hear is this plodding beat. And then you hear a guitar that sounds like it's going out of tune, but you hear, right? And then you hear this treated voice.
I am Iron Man.
Right? And I didn't know what I was supposed to think. We are talking about the power of these monolithic, iceberg-sized riffs that sort of lodge in your brain.
Nobody wants him. He just stares at the world.
It's kind of a depressing song about a creature being held in storage and coming to wreak revenge on people who've abandoned him.
Planning his vengeance that he will survive.
Thank you. Black Sabbath is not necessarily about pleasure. Black Sabbath is more about accessing the part of yourself that is bummed out. They try not to hit you with your libido, but hit you somewhere else, in your fists, right, or in your skull. With rock and roll, generally speaking, it's encouraging you to access your Dionysiac self who is experiencing pleasure, right? That's what rock and roll is about. But the Dionysiac impulse is also the flesh-eating impulse, right? The blood and guts, right? And I think those of us who are raised in academic environments don't really engage that as readily as kids who fight or play sports, you know? And I think interacting with metal was my gateway into sort of a harder connection to my body. But metal is a discipline. Guys who play heavy metal are like classical musicians. They're really good at what they do. Those guys can play all manner of scales and modes and can talk about them and are really excellent at it. Whereas I'm kind of a primitive guitarist. What I do is about getting my lyrics across.
I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do.
Because I come from, my father's an English professor and my stepfather's a political activist and my mother's a librarian, so my music stylistically couldn't really be further from heavy metal. But what I do, if you've seen me live, is very much about physical engagement and being very present in a single physical, bright, burning moment. I mean, even though I work with words, I'm always wanting to get to that level of poetry where when you say something, it's actually a physical event.
Hand in unlovable hand, and I hope you die. I hope we both die.
John Darnielle is the lead singer of the Mountain Goats. Their new album is called All Eternals Deck. Our story was produced by Stephen Reeder. Is there some piece of music that changed your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org. And while you're there, also check out our whole incredibly excellent new site. It's full of videos and music and daily dispatches on pop culture, as well as thousands of stories from Studio 360's archive. Coming up, the heart may be a lonely hunter, but two big singer-songwriters get together to make a theater piece about Carson McCullers.
After, you know, 15 years of, like, singing songs with your guitar about, like, you know, the girl who broke up with you or whatever, it gets really boring. It's nice to, like, write music about other people and inhabit other personalities and other personas.
Well, I still love Barely Breathing.
Okay, well, thanks.
Well, I know what you're doing. I see it all too clear.
Suzanne Vega and Duck and Sheik are ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Carson McCullers is one of those novelists who was a much bigger deal alive than she was dead. And that's maybe partly because the living McCullers was such an unusual person in 1940s and 50s America. She grew up in Georgia, and at 22 in 1940, her first novel became a huge bestseller, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. She was compared to Tennessee Williams and Flannery O'Connor. She drank prodigiously. Married, she had affairs with women. She seemed to enjoy being infamous, but she suffered from serious health problems all her life and died at 50. Her fiction chronicles misfits and outsiders, whom she wrote about in her lyrical, very southern way.
All day, there is the sound of the picks striking into the clay earth, hard sunlight, the smell of sweat. And every day there's music. One dark voice will start a phrase, half sung and like a question. And after a moment, another voice will join in. Soon the whole gang will be singing. The voices are dark in the golden glare, the music intricately blended, both somber and joyful. The music will swell until at last it seems that the sound does not come from the 12 men on the gang, but from the earth itself or the wide sky. It is music that causes the heart to broaden and the listener to grow cold with ecstasy and fright. Then slowly the music will sink down until at last there remains one lonely voice. Then a great hoarse breath, the sun, the sound of the picks in the silence.
That is from The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, read by the singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega. She is probably best known for a couple of hit pop songs in the 1980s. Remember Tom's Diner and Luca? Well, now she has added a second career branch, theater person. She has created and stars in a lovely new one-woman musical play called Carson McCullers Talks About Love.
New York is my destination. New York is where I will be from. New York is made for grander things just like me. I will lunch at the Algonquin, swing by the plaza, waltz on in the Three Olds Club. I'll live there indefinitely. 'Cause New York is made for grander things.
That is Suzanne Vega singing New York is My Destination from her one-woman show, Carson McCullers Talks About Love, with music co-written with Duncan Sheik. I guess in some ways the most surprising thing, in addition to the fact that it wasn't just you singing 14 songs, is that you act, and you act really well. How hard is it for you?
Well, I feel I know her. I feel that I inhabit her physically. It's technically hard because of how I hold my body. If you look at the photographs, you can see that for a lot of her life, she was paralyzed on the left side of her body. So I hold my body a certain way. I hold my hand a certain way. And so at the end of the week, I feel it in my back. I feel it in my neck.
Beyond the peculiarities of inhabiting her, You haven't been an actor. You haven't learned lines. You don't know where to...
No.
all that stuff. I mean, that would be so terrifying.
Well, I didn't know it was terrifying until about 4 weeks ago when I was suddenly confronted with the script that I'd spent a year and a half writing. And then suddenly I had to let go of that part of my brain that wants to write the script, and I had to learn the script. So that was the difficult part, was twirling myself around and saying, okay, let go of the playwriting part of it and just take the direction, do what you're told to do, move from here to there, get there on time, learn the lines. That's been probably one of the more difficult things, is learning 90 minutes of lyrics and also the lines. But I know them now, okay? I do.
Yes. It's now more than half your life, most of your life, that you have been interested, if not obsessed, with Carson McCullers. Tell the story of how you discovered her as a kid.
When I was at Barnard, I was given an assignment by my teacher, Shirley Kaplan. She said, come in dressed as someone in the arts who is no longer living. Be prepared to take questions. So I bought the book. I dressed as her. I learned about her life, and then I read all of her material. So I wouldn't say I've been obsessed with it, but...
But you've kind of been working on this for 30 years.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've put her away for big chunks of time. There were times where I had to put her away because she becomes all-consuming. She was a needy person in real life and continues beyond the grave to pull people in to her energy and her life story.
A song you wrote and performed as a hit, Tom's Diner, had this second life again as a huge hit for various musicians who covered and remixed it.
Yeah.
It's kind of what you're doing with Carson McCullers, sort of covering and remixing and reintroducing her to a world.
Yeah, I guess I am. I'm reinterpreting certain things. Hopefully I haven't gone too far afield of what her spirit is. I feel in some ways, although she was eccentric, she was kind of classic in her work. She wasn't like Gertrude Stein, avant-garde and using language in crazy ways. I feel that she was kind of a classicist with a huge twist.
Right.
A twisted classicist.
Duncan, you also, like Suzanne, were a singer-songwriter with a huge hit record in your 20s and then made the shift very successfully to musical theater with Spring Awakening. And in fact, I saw you referred recently by a critic as the Spring Awakening composer Duncan Sheik, as if your previous career didn't exist. How does that feel?
Well, you know, see, when I come here to the radio station, I don't have to play guitar. I don't have to play piano. I don't have to sing. I'm a composer.
That's right, Duncan. All he has to do is hear the oboes.
But, I mean, it must be, obviously, you've had great success in this career change, but to have the other one kind of erased occasionally, it must be a little odd.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's not erased. You know, I have a record coming out in June, but yeah, the theater is great because it's after, you know, 15 years of like singing songs with your guitar about like the girl who broke up with you or whatever, it gets really boring. It's nice to like write music about other people and inhabit other personalities and other personas. That's kind of a lot more fun in a way.
Well, I still love Barely Breathing.
Okay, well, thanks.
So when we share bills together, as we sometimes do, I am backstage singing and dancing around when he does Barely Breathing.
That's cute.
Yes, thanks.
So how did this process work? You would write lyrics and he would write music, or both? Or?
I would give Suzanne music.
He would give me between 2 minutes and 5 minutes of either, say, 2 minutes of something that was improvised, which I would then put the lyrics into it. The song we just heard, Duncan gave me the whole thing.
First,
he gave me the melody.
But did you start saying, I'm going to do this song about how I dream of New York, and then you would write music?
Yeah, I mean, in that case of that song, I was kind of thinking about, like, coming to New York City in the 40s and 50s and, I don't know, like, Peter Duchin Orchestra or something. You know, like, this kind of vibe.
It was very mid-century.
Yeah, this thing of, like, it's full of hope and possibility and lightness, which
and
is
you had the
not,
title. You had the title. New York is my destination. Yeah. And so I could feel in the melody that you'd given me, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that is, New York is my destination. It's, like, right there. And but it was what you had given me was almost like a Morse code, and I had to fit these short phrases.
Uh-huh. That's the easy job, though. Actually, I have to say, it's
for
really,
you,
it's,
maybe.
No, it's great. No,
not
it's
for
like,
me.
It's great because it's like, give me something that evokes this, you know, and then I can just say.
And he just did.
We all need a person like you, I think, in our respective fields. One of my favorite songs of the night is called Harper Lee, about the still living author of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
Will you play and sing it?
Sure, I would love to. And that goes for you too, Miss Harper Lee. Virginia Woolf, she leaves me cold. I recognize the genius, but I'm twice as bold. I have more to say than Hemingway. Lord knows, compared to Faulkner, I say it in a better way.
I'm gonna show her how. Yes, I will. I said to Reeves the other day, Proust really is the man who comforts me in a way no other writer can. The timeless quality of the work, the length is very long. Believe me, his Marcel Proust goes on and on and on. Seven volumes. Harper, Harper, Lee, Lee, Lee. She only wrote the one book. I've written more than three. Darling Tennessee Williams, it's anybody's guess why a streetcar made millions and weddings so much less.
That is Suzanne Vega singing Harper Lee from her show Carson McCullers Talks About Love with music co-written with Duncan Sheik. I love that song. I could I want to put that on my rotation and play it all the time. I especially love she only wrote the one book.
Which is true.
Which is true. Actually. But the one book
is
the kind of Midwestern or the provincial construction I grew up hearing my aunts say all around me all the time. Was she that arrogant? I mean, to say it's better than Gatsby, I'm better than Faulkner.
Well, I'll tell you the actual lines. She definitely said she had more to say than Hemingway, and that she said it better than Faulkner. Those are actual verbatim quotes.
Uh huh.
The final line, which is that she'd like to kill more than just that mockingbird, actually came from Duncan, which I thought was terribly witty, and I stole it and put it right at the end.
No, and as a late reveal for those who don't know who Harper Lee is, it was lovely.
Thanks.
It's my one contribution.
Speaking of lovely contributions, could you introduce the band, including your pianist who is a performer in the show?
Yes, he is. Mr. Joe Iconis on piano. And we have Andy Stack on guitar, banjo, harmonium, and ukulele.
Suzanne, so you started reading Carson McCullers when you're a teenager and then mm-hmm. in college.
Mm-hmm.
How was reading her and thinking about her and then all that her life was and meant different at 50 and 51 than it was at 20 and 21?
I kind of get it more. She doesn't seem quite as crazy to me now as she did when I was 20.
That's interesting. Well, when you were 20, you hadn't had your great successes in your 20s yet
no,
either, right?
I hadn't.
And that must have provided some sense of kinship now.
Only in retrospect. In retrospect,
yes.
I realize now, I had my record deal at 24. So, I mean, her life was incredibly difficult. So it's not a life you want to have a lot of parallels to be
right.
honest. But yeah, there have been some.
as you've described, Carson McCullers experienced tremendous personal difficulty. She drank a lot. She had strokes. Yeah. She was an invalid at 30. Her husband committed suicide. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger, do you think, in kind of over-investing in the romantic idea that important artists have to experience terrible personal pain and disaster?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that exactly. But the thing that you can point to is, A, she had the courage of her convictions and of her vision. She was very idiosyncratic, and she was not shy about expressing that fully in all her work. And she might not have lived a healthy lifestyle, but she certainly expressed herself to the fullest. And she was very, very disciplined. She wrote every morning. Didn't matter if she was up drinking all night. And the other thing that I so admire about her is when you read her books, you don't feel pity for her. And when you read her biographies, you don't feel pity. You don't feel this is a pitiful woman.
Suzanne Vega, Duncan Sheik, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carson McCullers Talks About Love is at the Rattlestick Playwrights Theater in New York City through June 5th. You can watch Suzanne Vega perform another song from the show for us at studio360.org, where you can also download our free podcast, sign up for our newsletter, and just spend all day hanging around. That's it for this week's program. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Eric Malinsky,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Katie Palmer,
Mary Dew.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What does it take to become a rock star?
At 15 years old, I had this unbelievably naive teenage dream of what I was going to do with my life. I actually had the audacity to carry that out.
Hey, baby, this is not a challenge.
It might have been my most courageous act.
REM's Michael Stipe. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.